I'm Dr. Leif Tapanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History, and I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho, and this is The Nature of Idaho. Coming to you from the 1B, Bannock County that is, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Our guest today is Shayna Drimmel. She's a wildlife program manager for the Greater Yellowstone Coalition. Today we're talking about Yellowstone, of course, but bison.
Bison
are amazing animals.
They are insane. They're just...
They're insane.
Absolutely beautiful animals.
In your zoo history, I know at Zoo Idaho, there are bison. Have you ever worked really... Like, do you have to work closely with them on a day-to-day basis?
So, yes and no. I mean, we just normal... daily maintenance and husbandry for them.
Sure.
I did, when I was going to grad school, you know, my research was with bison at the Tallgrass Prairie Preserve in Osage County in Oklahoma. And at that point, it was on 5,000 acres with their goal was 5,000 head. And then they had another 5,000 acres that ran cattle. And eventually they were going to have all the bison on 10,000 acres. So it was really kind of neat with the research where you had a prairie divided in half. So I had a control group the group with the bison on there. That was really fun and challenging.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how you persuade a bison to do what you want it to do.
You really don't. So...
Probably the right answer.
You ask nicely, and if they say no, then you just have to deal with it.
Exactly. Well, before we get into bison talk, you've got nature in the news.
Yeah, Leif, I think we'll all agree that there's too much plastic in the world, and we're running into issues with single-use plastic, and we're finding out that recycling plastic really doesn't work. There's just so many different types of plastic, and it's really hard to recycle because you've got to match the types with what you're doing and all that. And
sure.
Now, more and more research is coming out with just how prevalent micro and nanoplastics are found, and not just in the environment, but in our bodies. And you're assuming if it's in us, it's in the bodies of all the animals as well. And who knows, maybe phytoplankton is just everywhere. So people are looking at ways to kind of break this dependency on plastic. And we've got some researchers at South Dakota State University that are looking at plastic bags. We love plastic bags.
Sure do.
You go to a grocery store.
Single-use
plastic bags. I can remember when that was the new thing. Oh, plastic bags are better than paper bags.
They have a handle.
They have a handle, right? But no, they're not. So what they're looking at is plant material, especially cellulose, high cellulose plant material to make plastics. And a couple of researchers have found out that they started looking at grapevine canes. And grapevine canes, those are the horizontal branches that go off and hold the grapes. So they train the vines to go along the top of the fence. And those canes get trimmed back every year when the grapes are harvested.
So there's a source of cellulose.
And it's an abundant source.
Yeah.
And they're really rich in cellulose. And one of the things that is really inviting with the film that these grapevine canes produce is it's very transparent.
Okay.
So when you kind of look at some of the single-use plastic now, whether you've got fruit in there or your favorite sandwich, people want to be able to see the product.
Sure. And
the more transparent it is, the more enticing it is for the product.
Right.
And then with their grapevine cane bags, the tensile strength is significantly stronger than your plastic bags.
Okay, right.
So, you know, less tearing
less
and then
tearing
your groceries
and
go everywhere.
Yeah.
But the big one is they found out that these bags will start to biodegrade within 17 days of coming in contact with soil.
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah.
So they break down.
They break down.
In 17 days is
17
quick.
Is super fast. So.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and it's a good direction
to
go.
So I wonder if that could be brought into production. And certainly there's plenty of grapevine material out there, right?
Yep.
So it's a matter of scaling it up and so
And, of
forth.
Course, the grapevine material is a renewable resource.
Absolutely.
So.
Sounds like a win-win.
Yes, it does.
Wonderful.
So drink more wine.
Drink. That's the solution to all of life's problems, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe the cause of them, too. Who knows? Trivia time. How many average miles does a bison roam in Yellowstone on an average year? You will be amazed. When we come back from the break, Shayna Drimmel joins us, and we're going to talk all about the bison in Yellowstone. Stay tuned.
Get continued access to local news and all the programs you enjoy through the Listen Live link at KISU.org. Or try using your web-connected Amazon or Google smart speaker with the command, Play KISU.
Hey, welcome back from the break. Our guest today is Shana Drimmel. She's from the Greater Yellowstone Coalition. So first off, welcome to The Nature of Idaho.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited about today's conversation.
Well, we're going to talk about bison, but first, Shana, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Sure. So I am a wildlife program manager for the Greater Yellowstone Coalition based in Bozeman, Montana. I'm a wildlife biologist by training and trade. Before joining GYC, I spent more than a decade researching a whole slew of iconic and rather controversial species, including wolves and grizzly bears, wolverines, bison, of course, both in Yellowstone and throughout the Northern Rockies in Alaska, and even African carnivores in Zambia. I've been with GYC for about 10 and a half years now. I currently lead our policies and programs aimed at restoring Yellowstone bison to tribal and public ancestral lands within the greater Yellowstone ecosystem and beyond. I also coordinate and lead our efforts to support migratory ungulates, landscape permeability, and connectivity throughout greater Yellowstone. A little bit more specifically about our bison program. Most wildlife in Yellowstone, as you know, can freely migrate in and out of Yellowstone National Park. However, bison remain largely confined to its boundaries with only very limited access to important winter habitat areas outside the park. And so our program really is working toward a future where these bison can roam beyond the park within designated tolerance areas where migration pathways are restored and bison are recognized and managed more as the valued migratory wildlife species that they are, rather than through slaughter and culling and hazing. And then more broadly, we're working to support wild disease-free Yellowstone bison being used to support the ecological and cultural restoration of bison on tribal lands and eventually public ancestral lands across North America.
So when we look at bison moving outside of the Yellowstone area, what's holding them back right now? Why are they still basically being confined within the park?
Yeah, that's a very complicated question. It's not easy to answer. There's a whole combination of things. I would say in general, it's largely due to a lack of tolerance by the state of Montana. Bison primarily want to migrate out of the north and west areas of the park into the Gardner Basin and the Hebgen Basin areas. And you know, while there is definitely tolerance for bison within the communities in these areas due to many years of coexistence work, I think there's overall just a lack of tolerance by the state of Montana and the current state administration. And so the other thing that is at play here is that there are other barriers to wildlife and bison movement in particular, and that includes just a lack of suitable habitat for bison outside of the park. A lot of the areas where bison want to roam now, where their natural winter habitat is actually, you know, privately owned. There's houses, there's communities, there's fences, there's roads. You know, outside of West Yellowstone, there's an interstate there, that highway there, that actually is a pretty big barrier to their movement. And in fact, many bison are hit and killed along that roadway there. There is also a lot of hunting that takes place right outside of Yellowstone National Park. There's a tribal bison hunt, and a lot of that hunting takes place in a very sort of limited area of public land that is right on the border of Yellowstone National Park. And so a lot of those bison don't make it beyond that area. They're either shot and killed or they are sort of pushed back into the park. There are many, many reasons why, but I think in general, I think the solution to really getting more bison out on the larger landscape outside of Yellowstone is to, work towards securing some additional suitable habitat for bison, larger tracts of public land so that they can, really move more freely. There can be a more sort of dispersed and improved tribal hunt. That bison just have more room to roam essentially without coming into contact with people.
So some of our listeners might ask the question, why is it important to expand the range of bison? Can you help make the case for a variety of reasons why bison matter in our region?
I think bison can they play an incredibly important role in the ecosystem. They help improve, grassland, the health of the grasslands, and the northern range. Actually, there's new research coming out that's demonstrating that, the places where bison graze along the northern range are actually more healthy. Even though they come back to those areas and repeatedly graze them, those areas are showing increases in nitrogen content, and they're actually more nutritious than the areas where they're not being grazed. And I think in other, there's a lot of other research beyond Yellowstone showing that bison can have sort of regenerative impacts on grassland ecosystems, and they impact a whole slew of other species and within grassland ecosystems. And they just play a really important part in the larger sort of ecology of an area.
I think when we look at, for me growing up in Iowa and really kind of living in the Great Plains, whether it's tall, mixed, or short, when you had, was it how many millions of bison that basically that entire ecosystem evolved and really developed around the bison? They were the major animal in there, and they migrated Canada, Texas, back and forth. So they're always, the ecosystem developed around the bison. And by pulling the bison out,
Right.
you've changed the ecosystem because the primary component is now gone.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean their movements, their grazing, their wallowing, so much of their whole ecology and their behavior has direct impacts on how that ecosystem functions. And they were integral to grassland health for thousands of years.
What's our estimated population, standing population in Yellowstone National Park right now? What's the best sort of number?
Yeah, so today there's roughly about 5,000 bison in Yellowstone. It's probably a little bit under 5,000 after last year's removal efforts, but yeah, there's about 5,000.
So 5,000, and historically that number was drastically smaller than that. How small was the population at one time in Yellowstone?
Yeah, so as you just mentioned, only a couple hundred years ago, there were tens of millions of bison that roamed, from Mexico to Canada, shaping ecosystems and sustaining native cultures for thousands of years. However, it was 1902, there was only 23 wild bison remaining in Yellowstone, and these were the last truly wild plains bison left after the federal government's campaign to eradicate bison in an act of war against Native American tribes.
And so getting from 23 individuals up to 5,000, that seems like a quite an achievement
Yeah, for sure.
over what, well, a century and a bit. How did that happen?
Yeah, so in Yellowstone National Park really did play a key role in the conservation of wild bison in North America. And those last remaining 23 bison back in 1902 really became significant to saving wild plains bison from extinction. So this was really considered one of the first efforts to preserve a wildlife species through protection and stewardship. The U.S. Army, which managed Yellowstone at the time in the early 1900s, I think it was in 1902, they purchased 21 additional animals from private herds and raised them in the park. And they did that for a number of years, through animal husbandry. And actually, they were contained in the Lamar Valley at the Buffalo Ranch there. Eventually, those bison were released and allowed to mix with the remnant wild herd. And by the mid-1900s, the total population, I think, had grown to over 1,000. And then for many years, Yellowstone managed the herd by culling them. I'm fearing that like bison and elk would overgraze the range. And then that changed in 1968 when the park adopted a natural regulation approach. So at that point, letting ecological processes manage the herd. And then because bison are highly productive, their population grew rapidly, basically exponentially. And now, today we have around 5,000 bison in the park. But as you probably know, even though this is one of the, America's greatest conservation success stories, and that we went from 23 wild bison to now 5,000 or so in the park today, this story has not been without controversy. And I would argue that, the future of our national mammal still faces risks to meaningful restoration. And so what's happening is that Yellowstone is a high elevation plateau and really does not include suitable winter habitat for most migrating ungulate species, including bison. So similar to elk and pronghorn, much of the winter range for bison exists only in the lower elevation valley bottom areas that are outside of Yellowstone National Park. And so as bison numbers steadily increased over the last century, I think about by the time, we hit the 80s and early 90s, certainly they began resuming their natural migratory patterns and began leaving the park to try and access these winter ranges north and west of Yellowstone. And this put them at the center of an intense and honestly ongoing wildlife controversy. So really what happens is that when bison leave the park, they encounter a very different world now, a landscape that's become a maze of development and fenced pastures and houses and highways and of course livestock. And bison are large, 1,000 to 2,000 pound animals, and having them searching for food on the landscape can create challenges for people and livestock, both in terms of human safety and because bison want to eat the same grass that ranchers grow to feed their livestock. And of course, bison and elk carry the livestock disease brucellosis. So that's presents a whole nother issue that we have to deal with. And really, it's due to these fears around brucellosis being transmitted to livestock and just a general lack of tolerance, primarily from the livestock community. Since about the 80s, Yellowstone has been forced to heavily manage this bison population, both their numbers as well as their distribution outside the park, through hazing and culling and shipping bison to slaughter. And since 2000, I think more than 7,000 Yellowstone bison have been sent to slaughter. And for us and many others, I would say that's kind of a tragedy. This is our most ecologically and culturally significant wild herd. And I believe we can do better without putting livestock producers and communities at risk.
And I think this is great. So let's move towards the Yellowstone Bison Coexistence Program and kind of talk about what this program does and what your goal is.
Sure. Yeah. So back in 2011, we started the Yellowstone Bison Coexistence Program. This is a collaborative effort between GYC and some of our conservation partners, including Defenders of Wildlife, in collaboration with Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. The program really aims to mitigate potential conflicts and concerns over wild bison roaming beyond the park boundaries by offering financial and technical assistance to landowners that are interested in building bison exclusion fences on private property, to prevent property damage and to keep bison out of potential conflict areas, including gardens and landscaping and yards, playgrounds, or livestock pastures, where they can potentially cause damage or come into conflict with people, pets, and/or livestock. Our primary goal through this program is to promote increased tolerance of bison on the landscape outside the park, by helping to provide a means for people to successfully coexist with them. It's really rather simple, but it's effective. It's a solution-based program that really benefits both people on the ground and wild bison. More specifically, through the program, participating landowners can receive both technical assistance and a 50% reimbursement up to $1,500 towards labor and material costs to construct the fencing. But we do consider larger cost share contributions on a case by case basis. Also importantly, our participants are encouraged to build fences with the smallest possible footprint on the landscape and that meet Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks recommendations for wildlife-friendly fencing that allows for the passage of species other than bison, including pronghorn and elk, especially where fencing may impact wildlife corridors. And so in this case, what a lot of people don't realize is that it takes a lot more to contain bison, to fence bison in, than it does to fence bison out. And so in this case, we're really typically talking about kind of your standard backyard fences, you know, standard post and rail, jackleg fence, even some wire caging around individual trees or shrubs. And so, yeah, it doesn't take a whole heck of a lot to really make a difference here. And we've completed now about 60 projects in the Gardner and Hebgen basins. And I would say overall, this has just been a really incredible, successful program that has significantly reduced reports of property damage by landowners and just conflicts in general between bison and landowners in these basins. And just really allowing residents to more fully enjoy living alongside these amazing animals. So I think simple solutions like putting up a fence can really help prevent unnecessary conflicts and go a long way in helping communities accept these animals' presence on the landscape. I will say too, before we started the Yellowstone Bison Coexistence Program, beginning in the early 2000s, we really set out to focus on, securing habitat for bison to use outside Yellowstone so that they would be allowed to migrate and access important winter forage and calving grounds outside of the park. And this was accomplished through implementing various conflict prevention measures in addition to the Bison Coexistence Program so that we could slowly build social tolerance for and acceptance of bison on this landscape. So in the early days, much of that work included voluntary grazing allotment buyouts, and as well as land leases to remove potential cattle conflicts from the landscape. An example of this, in 2008, GYC and our conservation partners worked with the National Park Service and Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks to purchase a 30-year lease on a very large section of land owned by a ranch in the Gardner Basin, just north of Yellowstone. This is a major migration area for bison. So as part of the deal, the ranch agreed to retire cattle grazing on their property and allow bison to move through a section of their land so that they could access an additional 75,000 acres of public land on the other side. And then in addition, we helped to retire some of the last remaining cattle grazing allotments on Forest Service lands, both in the Upper Gallatin area west of the park and in the Gardner Basin as well. And so by, alleviating the risks associated with having wild bison in close proximity to communities and people and livestock operations in these areas north and west of the park, we were really able to sort of prime the landscape for the return and acceptance of wild bison. And this was really, really important and a critical piece to eventually establishing and then later expanding what are called these bison tolerance areas, where bison are now technically allowed to go outside the park. And this, we've slowly built on over the years. And so, progress has felt slow in recent years for sure, but when we really look back 25 years, we've come a tremendous way. We went from essentially zero tolerance for bison outside Yellowstone, where, in the 90s, any bison attempting to leave the park, they were oftentimes immediately shot, to now more than 375,000 acres of habitat outside Yellowstone, where these bison are allowed to roam now.
That's great. And I think the idea of changing people's attitudes and acceptance of these animals can only increase when there's a means for people to sort of coexist side by side. And I think that can relax some fears maybe about the negative impacts that bison can have, and maybe actually flip that and turn it into a positive
almost a value add to the landscape when they know that wild bison are in that region, and that, you know, it would be possible to see a bison someday in an adjacent landscape to where you live or to where you work.
I think too, when we look at that, people are always leery or afraid of change, and then coming in and saying, hey, look, we do have some simple solutions, cost-effective solutions that you can do and we'll help you do. And all of a sudden they're like, oh, you know, it's not that big of a deal. I thought it was going, you're going to come in and say, I had to do this, 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 take this away. It's going to cost me thousands and thousands of dollars. And all of a sudden they realize it's actually relatively simple. And all of a sudden they're able to sit out there and enjoy bison moving through their property and not worry and just enjoy.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so we know coexistence is possible, you know, in these places where bison already live, for example, outside Yellowstone, tolerance has grown and it's actually quite high now as people have learned to live with them on the landscape. A lot of the people that we talk to in these communities, they just love the bison and they so appreciate now that they can sit on their back porch and really, you know, watch them, you know, graze by and they feel safe and they're not, you know, destroying their trees and their gardens and they really enjoy it. And I agree. I think there are a lot of things that you have to consider. There are real risks, but there are also real solutions to those risks and ways to make it work. I think that you can have bison, you know, in a lot of, I don't think bison can be everywhere. I do not think they can be everywhere. But I do think that we can and should find some appropriate and suitable areas, including on public lands, where we can restore some large free-roaming herds. And I also believe that bison and livestock can share the landscape. There are actually many successful examples of this in other places. And again, going back to your point, there's just so many tools available today to prevent conflicts and to support a shared landscape. And to your point, bison could bring big benefits to communities. There's just massive tourism dollars. There's tremendous hunting opportunities. They're one of the most sought after game species in the country. Grassland restoration and a plethora of other ecological benefits while still protecting livestock, working lands, and people's way of life. It's about working with people on the ground, affected stakeholders, the agencies, you know, political leadership to find common ground and to identify creative opportunities for bison restoration in select areas that can benefit all people involved.
That's really great. And I feel like I have to remind people that you can enjoy bison, but not too close.
Yes.
You don't need a selfie. So yeah.
They can move pretty fast, right?
Yes.
They can move pretty fast and can be kind of ornery.
And yep. Big.
Absolutely.
And they're big.
Yeah.
They will
yes.
win.
Yeah.
Yes. But just like many other wildlife species.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Elk can be dangerous. Moose can be dangerous. Obviously bears.
That's right.
So,
that's right.
Yeah.
It's no different. Now, can you help us with our trivia question for today? I love this question. How many average miles does a bison roam in Yellowstone in a year?
Sure. So most bison here in Yellowstone travel about 1,000 miles over the course of a year, both through migration, but also by repeatedly leaving and returning to the same areas to intensely graze those areas that they like. And so this means that bison travel a greater distance than any other ungulate in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, which is truly incredible given their range beyond Yellowstone is quite actually constrained, unlike for other migrating species. So that's pretty awesome.
That's great. And you know what? I'm going to challenge you, Leaf, that starting today, we're going to see if you or I can walk 1,000 miles in a year.
Okay.
So,
okay. It's
yeah.
on.
Yep. We got this.
So, I know. I wonder how many steps that is per day.
Right.
Right.
Awesome. Shana, thank you so much for joining us. And for anyone who wants to learn more about Yellowstone and the conservation work that's happening up there, please visit greateryellowstone.org. And again, Shana, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
The Nature of Idaho receives support from listener contributions to KISU. Shows are produced at the KISU studios in Pocatello at Idaho State University with editing and production by Mackenzie Young. Music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock. Audio of all past episodes can be found at KISU.org and select podcast services. Send your thoughts and suggestions to NOIDKISU@ISU.edu.